I have not forgotten that I was in the middle of a two-part sermon series when tragedy struck on September 11th. I plan on getting back to the second and final part of that series soon. You may recall the series deals with the cultural lens through which we see the world and how our cultural lens sometimes skews our view of nature and the environment. Although the subject of our search for a middle ground between the industrialists and the environmentalists is delayed, the idea of a cultural lens should certainly hang in the background of today's discussion. If you'll recall, the first part of that series talked about how our cultural lens shapes the way we see the world. Twin brothers raised in different cultures would grow up to see the world in radically different ways. Their eyes would be genetically identical, but the way they interpret what they see would be anything but identical. I think we've all been shaken by the notion that there are people who have been culturally conditioned to hate all things American and all things Western. The person who would hijack an airliner and crash it into a skyscraper is seeing the world through a cultural lens that's entirely alien to you and me. And what frightens and amazes me the most out of all the hideously frightening elements of this whole tragedy is that those terrorists lived among us for an extended period of time. I mean, I can understand how a person could be raised to hate, and who, through isolation from other people and other ideas, could develop an anger and a hatred for America. The idea that a person can be culturally brainwashed does not surprise me at all. But these guys lived among us, and I don't understand how they were able to maintain their hatred once they got to know men, women, and children, everyday Americans, just like the ones they were planning to murder. They went to the grocery store, studied at various schools, lived with and among American people for an extended period of time. How did their hatred of the American system overcome their knowledge that human beings everywhere are basically good, kind, loving people? Normally, the best way to get rid of one's blanket hatred is to live among the people you've been taught to hate. The most prejudiced people I was aware of when I was growing up were people who had absolutely no contact with those they were prejudging. If a person is unfortunate enough to be raised by a family that advocates hate for black people or white people or Latino people or Oriental people, that person is likely to grow up culturally conditioned to hate. But all it takes for that ignorant hatred to vanish is to actually get to know a real live person within the group you've been taught to hate. The fact that the men who committed these atrocities had gotten to know people in this country and still chose to carry out those acts is chilling. I always thought that as misguided and vicious as Stalin was, he knew what he was talking about when he said the death of a single person is a tragedy. The death of 1,000 people is a statistic. I can envision how a person raised to hate could push a button and kill thousands of people with whom he's never had any contact. I still can't figure out how somebody could live among us, get to know us, and then, while looking innocent men, women, and children in the eye, annihilate massive numbers of human beings. That's a cultural lens I do not understand. But one thing is clear. These people are among us. They're scattered all over the world. Our situation would be much more tenable if these folks were all gathered together in one place. I mean, Nazi Germans were a wretched lot, but at least we knew where to drop the bombs. I heard last week that there are as many as 5,000 people in England who may be sympathetic to Osama bin Laden. It's important to remember at times like these that we can't believe everything we hear, but if that statistic is true, what do we do? Reduce London to rubble? As much as the Bible is misused, abused, and twisted around to support various agendas, I remain amazed at the wisdom of Jesus. And when I came to fully understand the situation we currently face, with hate-filled terrorists scattered across the globe and hidden among perfectly innocent people, the parable of the weeds among the wheat we heard read from the lectern this morning sprang instantly to mind. When we hear this parable, it's important for us to think of it in two ways. First, we can think of it from the view of the whole world. The good seed and bad seed are scattered over the earth, and uprooting the bad seed likewise uproots the good. That speaks directly to the difficult issues we are facing as we try to determine how to bring to justice the deplorable people who inflicted these atrocities upon the world. The second way of viewing the parable is to look at it from a personal perspective. The world itself sows both good and bad seed within the lives of each one of us. What kind of soil are we? What kind of fruit do we bring forth into this world? As we seek to respond to the tragedy we currently face, it's our challenge to bring forth good fruit, to ourselves scatter good seed in this world, even in the face of evil. Even when it would be much more gratifying to abandon our faith for a short time and return evil for evil in a way that would really teach those folks a lesson. That's a temptation we just can't give in to. We can't allow ourselves to become the weeds in the story, regardless of how angry and how hurt we are. Turning the whole garden into a field of weeds is not the answer to the problem. Going back once again to the wisdom of Jesus, we have to remember it is the nature of the world to be a combination of weeds and wheat. Time and again, and with matters of much less consequence than we have witnessed of late, we are faced with the fact that this world is often not a trustworthy place. The family into which we're born, the country we love, the church to which we belong, all of these things at one time or another may let us down. We may not fully understand why God created this particular world with its unsettling mixture of beauty and ugliness, joy and despair, good and evil. But this is the world we've been given, and for every mountain there is a valley. For every joyous day, there is a night of cruelty. For every act of inspirational courage, there is an act of faithless pettiness. Part of what the parable of the weeds and the wheat tells us is that we have to maintain our faith throughout. That's not to say we should stand idly by and watch evil prevail. It would be a terrible misinterpretation of the message of Jesus to think this story is a divine command to ignore injustice. This is not a call to remain passive in the face of evil. It is instead a perfectly rational reminder that human beings have not been given the ability to rid the world of all its weeds. We've not been given the power to eliminate evil from this world. And in light of that fact, we should be extremely prudent when trying to remove the weeds, or our attempts to pluck them up may do more harm than good. This is the world we've been given to share. No amount of stomping, shouting, or praying is going to change the rules. But that doesn't mean we're lost forever in a world that's been hopelessly compromised by evil. The parable of the weeds and the wheat assures us that the weeds will ultimately be destroyed, that in the end, good really does conquer evil, in spite of how it sometimes appears. And that's the basis of our faith. Evil is temporary. Good is forever. If there's a better reason to adhere to our faith, I can't imagine what it is. Evil is temporary. good is forever. For that reason alone, we should always be diligent in making sure we take the high road, that when the line between good and evil is drawn, we're always on the side of good, and by a considerable distance. And as we stand against evil, which is surely our task, we should remember the purpose of a faithful Christian life. It's not our call to defeat evil, but to stand against it. It's not our call to bring about the ultimate fulfillment of God's purposes in this world, but to live as faithfully and obediently as possible, always trusting in the goodness of God. When I spoke on the Sunday following the terrorist attack, I said it was our duty to stand against evil. We have a moral obligation to the civilized world to make sure the people who perform these unspeakably evil acts never do so again. But I also said we must be extremely cautious not to return evil for evil, that if our justifiable anger devolves into a vengeful hatred that destroys everything in its path, including men, women, and children who are just as innocent as the victims of the terrorists' hatred, then we've sunk to their level of evil. If and when that day arrives, we can't claim to be any better than they are. I mentioned the high number of fundamentalist Muslim extremists in England who are purported to be sympathetic with the agenda of Osama bin Laden, because it reveals the difficulty in separating the wheat from the chaff in this situation. There are certainly elements of this insidious terrorist network at work on American soil. I feel great sympathy, by the way, for the peace-loving Americans of the Islamic faith, and for that matter, people of Middle Eastern descent everywhere who are under suspicion because of their ethnicity. I hope we go to extreme measures to assure our desire for security doesn't turn into blind prejudice. When we met here at the church for a prayer service on the Friday following the terrorist attack, I said that times such as these bring out the very best in people and the very worst in people. There is a certain attitude that has taken over a lot of people that says, let's drop some bombs before we lose our resolve. This attitude was there from the very start. 2 days after the attack, I recall the Secretary of Defense answering questions at a press conference. Of course, we knew considerably less then than we know now. The Secretary of Defense was asked if he knew who did it, and he said, no, although we had our suspects. He was asked if he knew what countries might be involved, and he again said, no, but we have our suspicions. And then he was asked if the United States had established a timetable for retaliation. I thought that was the dumbest question I'd ever heard. What was he going to say? Yes, we're going to start dropping bombs on somebody tomorrow, and we sure hope we know who the enemy is by then. And now, the longer our anger simmers, the more we see it bubbling over here and there. The rhetoric on talk radio is getting awfully ugly. And I understand the anger, the frustration, but I sure wish people would stop fanning the embers of irrational hatred. Considering how the enemy in this situation is so thoroughly mixed in among perfectly innocent people, some people seem to want to react like Frank Burns on the old MASH television show. Do you remember him? If you'll recall, Major Frank Burns had this ongoing affair with Major Hot Lips Houlihan. When he suspected her of cheating on him, he said, if I ever catch you with another man, I'll blow my brains out and then kill the both of you. I mean, we've got the weeds among the wheat, and burning the whole field may sound like a good idea at first blush, but let's hope cooler heads prevail. Well, I realize this isn't really a laughing matter, and I pray our leaders continue to show good judgment and restraint as we seek ways to confront the evil that has been thrust upon the world. Obviously, this is not a situation we can walk away from as if it never happened. But a large and brutal military strike, in spite of what we hear on talk radio, is simply not the answer. We need to remember that the overwhelming majority of governments in the Middle Eastern world are behind us and at great risk to themselves. Each of these nations has a radical element in it that hates everything American. Those anti-American people consider their governments traitors to Islam, at least to their narrow and ugly version of Islam, when their governments cooperate with the United States. And consider this, our nation is normally bitterly divided in a thousand ways over a thousand different issues. But once we felt an outside force had unjustly attacked us, we came together. We united in a way that most people would have thought impossible on September 10th. We have to realize that if we attack another nation, and especially if innocent lives are lost in the course of that attack, the people of that nation will come together the same way we did when we felt victimized. And if the attack takes innocent lives in the Arab world, well, the prospect of the entire Arab community uniting behind radical factions is something we need to avoid. We all understand the logic behind the idea that when a nation is attacked, it should strike back quickly and decisively. The thought is to let everybody know that if they kill one of ours, we'll kill 10 of theirs. And there would seem to be a certain wisdom in that philosophy, but we should remember it is the antithesis of the message of Jesus. And not only that, real-world experience tells us that we should perhaps give that idea a close look, because if it worked, Israel would be the safest place on earth. They've followed that philosophy for years, perhaps justifiably and perhaps not, but one fact is inarguable. Today, Israel may be the least safe place on the planet. Will the United States versus the terrorists do for the earth what Israel versus the Palestinians has done for the Middle East? There are a couple of analogies I want to mention because they speak directly to the situation we face with the weeds among the wheat. Imagine your child coming home from school after being beaten up by four or five bullies. These guys had slapped him around, humiliated him in front of everybody, taken his lunch money, and finally pummeled him until he was almost dead. I can barely imagine how we would feel in this situation. Our anger, our frustration, our desire for revenge would be palpable and justifiable. What would we do? How would we react? There are those in our nation at this point in time who, faced with this situation, would say the answer is to blow up the school and everybody in it. At least that would get those five guys. And we wouldn't have to worry about them beating up our child anymore. But at what price? I heard the other analogy about a week ago, and it resonated with me probably in light of the fact that I lived in Oklahoma City when the Murrah Building was bombed, and I now consider myself a Kansan. Should the Oklahoma National Guard have launched an all-out attack on Kansans, since a couple of terrorists, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, conceived their plot and built their bomb in this state? And what would your reaction be to the state of Oklahoma if members of your family were killed by Oklahoma's demand for vengeance? Well, I know those analogies are over the top, but they might not seem that way if, instead of being born in this country we love, we had been born in Afghanistan or Iraq or any of the other places some of our fellow citizens are saying we should attack without reservation and without remorse. It really is up to us, people of faith, to stand together for what is right. Of course we want justice. Of course we want the terror to stop. But let us be careful not to uproot the wheat along with the weeds, because we may inadvertently sacrifice something even more important than the wheat. We may sacrifice the most important thing of all, our faith.